woman was found dead in a van parked in Anchorage Sunday night after cold weather. We don't know all the facts yet, but we do know homelessness in Alaska kills. And after decades of trying, we don't seem to be making much progress with saving those lives. But there's a new idea which is spreading across the state, simply put, homeless in apartments. Some of them may continue deadly alcoholic lifestyles, but at least they won't die of the cold. The concept is called Housing First, and it's our topic this morning on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Kinnick Arm Bridge would create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, sitting in this morning for Steve Heimel. Our topic this morning is homelessness, and we're going to be concentrating primarily on chronic homelessness, not the person who is down on their luck for a few weeks and doesn't necessarily have a place to live and maybe could bed down at the shelter or in a neighbor's couch, but those people who are homeless for years and because of maybe a problems in their lives that make it difficult for them to function in society in terms of getting an apartment and being able to just live the way most of us do. And those people are very vulnerable in a state where the weather is cold. And so we read these tragic stories in the newspaper. There was one in this morning's newspaper in Anchorage. We don't know the facts, the name of the woman, or even if it was this kind of situation, but apparently she had been living in a van. And so what do we do about that? How are we going to, do we accept that? Or are we going to try to get these people indoors and get them safe? That's our topic today. And I've got three guests in the studio to talk about it. Melinda Freeman is director of the Rural Cap Supportive Housing Division. Melinda? Well, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Charles.
Wanda Connolly is a Rural Cap case manager. Wanda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And a little later, we're going to be talking with Nancy Burke, who's with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Program. And Melinda, I just thought, just to orient the listeners, this idea of housing first is different from the traditional way of handling homelessness. How? What makes it different?
Well, Housing First has actually been around in the lower 48 for over 20 years. The difference between Housing First and typical housing programs are that we offer permanent, safe and secure housing without preconditions. We recognize as a society that people who are suffering from chronic homelessness often have mental illness and chronic alcoholism and other medical conditions. If we provide them with safe housing and they are tenants, they're renters just like if you or I were renting, but we provide them with housing first, these other issues can be addressed after we bring them into housing. We can help them get medical care, dental care, vision care, and help them stabilize their lives. The difference is that typically in programs prior to Housing First, you require people to take mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment. And then if they're housing ready, so to speak, they're provided with housing. We found that this doesn't really work. The reverse is what is most effective.
So you have someone on the street who's a severe alcoholic or has a mental health problem. It's really hard to treat that problem when they're living on the street. And so they might not ever make that step. Is that part of the concept?
That is part of the concept, that often people have traumatic brain injuries. They have a great deal of trauma in their background, so they naturally mistrust systems of care. So our belief at Rural Cap and through working with the Mental Health Trust and other agencies is you bring the service to the person and continue to invite them in until they feel enough trust to decide that perhaps they deserve a home. And then you go from there building all the services around the person rather than expecting them to comply or be part of the system of services.
I see. And we talked about this spreading around Alaska. There's a facility in Anchorage, Karlick Manor, which is an old hotel which was converted. It's been almost a year in place.
Yes, December 8th.
And then it started in other communities, or other communities are thinking about it. What's happening around Alaska?
Yes, well, it's an exciting time for addressing homelessness. We have a program with 47 units in Fairbanks run by Tanana Chiefs, and then they have converted an old hotel as well on Cushman. And then in Juneau, the Juneau Coalition on Homelessness is addressing the same issue and looking at what projects they might develop.
All right. And other communities sort of studying it beyond that?
Yes, the hub communities, Bethel and Nome and other hub areas around Alaska, they also have chronically homeless individuals, not just people that are situationally homeless, but 10 to 20 people at any given time that have struggled with finding and obtaining safe housing. So this is being addressed across Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Well, Awanda, I wanted to turn to you. You work with homeless folks who I guess are coming in off the street and trying to get them into a place where they can get cared for and get warm and safe. Is this a tough time of year for people who are living outdoors?
Yes. I mean, people die left and right when they're out in the cold. It's a bad time during winter here in Alaska.
Yeah. And here in Anchorage, where are the homeless primarily living who are not getting into shelter?
In camps.
So back in the woods and that kind of thing?
Back in the woods. Sometimes they drink to get in to sleep off, to brack high enough to get in there.
So in other words, you get drunk enough, then you'll be
warm for the night.
Right. Wow. Now, you are from Anchorage. You have family from Point Hope, right?
Yes.
But you at one point were in a similar situation in terms of not having a place to sleep?
Yeah. I was homeless before recovery. I was homeless with my children.
Mm-hmm.
I would lose my housing because of the alcoholism, and I would be in hotels, sleeping on couches.
Yeah, wow, that must have been really difficult with kids. I mean, how do you take care of your kids in that situation?
It was hard, and I had family who would help out here and there. I did the best I could,
mm-hmm.
basically.
And then at some point, you were able to turn it around and get into recovery. And what helped you do that, or what was the thing that happened?
Well, first off, it was my mom and stepdad taking me in, and I didn't sober up at first. It took about a year for me to finally stop completely, and then the support of the services and the community and my stepdad.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of needed a safe place to go to first. You couldn't get into sobriety when you were just out in a chaotic living situation.
No. I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to numb out just to make it through the day.
Yeah, because life is so bad, then that is a crutch that's getting you through it, right?
Yes.
Wow. So, I mean, this housing first concept makes a lot of sense from that point of view.
It does. I mean, when you're stable, in stable housing, you can address the alcoholism or drug addiction and mental health. A lot of people, including myself, would drink to self-medicate.
Right. And so it's good. Get some real medication, right?
Yeah.
So, having been out there, it must really hit you hard when you hear about another person passing away because of being out in the cold.
It does hit me hard, and sometimes they are the ones we served at Homeward Bound.
Oh, so some folks you know.
Yes.
Yeah. And they just can't keep... They just can't keep sober, and they end up going off.
Well, when you're sobering up, you have to deal with the traumatic stuff, your mental health issues. So it's hard to face those things, you know. It's complex, and you have the mental health issues, you have the drug addiction, alcoholism, and then the financial. So it's all combined. It's just very complex. But the first step is to get into the stable housing to get the services to help you deal with the other stuff.
Right. And you could have all those problems going on at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. It's Talk of Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. I've got guests in the studio to talk about housing and this idea that get people into stable housing and then try to deal with their problems, which, and as we're talking about it, seems like it makes a lot of sense. I don't know why we didn't think about this before. Melinda Freeman is with me. She's the director of Rural CAP Supportive Housing Division, and Wanda Conley, who's a case manager at Rural CAP. And we would love to get you on the air, either with a phone call or an email. If the phone number from all over Alaska, toll-free, is 800-478-8255, 800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. And the email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And I invite you to check out our website, alaskapublic.org. We have a page up with some resources and links on this topic. Melinda, I'm thinking a little bit the devil's advocate here, but the rest of us pay for our housing, right? I mean, we work and we get housing because we earn the money, we choose a home to live in, and we behave responsibly. Is it fair, I guess, to put somebody in housing who really doesn't take any of those responsibilities, even to the point of taking care of themselves physically? And is that an issue that you have to think about?
Sure. We think about all aspects of Housing First, and I think that's a very, very good question. Housing First addresses all of these issues. We are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in Anchorage responding to homelessness the way we have been for decades, where people go in and out of shelters, they go in and out of emergency rooms, in and out of correctional facilities, API, the Psychiatric Institute, etc. That costs an average about $60,000 a year. If you place someone in safe and secure housing with wraparound services, that's around $23,000 to $24,000 a year. And it's important to clarify that the individuals that live at Karluk Manor or up in Fairbanks are tenants. They pay rent if they are able to, 30% of their income. If not, we do have vouchers provided by HUD. And those vouchers allow us as a community to save a great deal of money. We actually employ some of the tenants at Karluk Manor. They work in the custodial capacity. We also help people with employment. I think it's a misconception that people that are chronically homeless don't move into employment, because many of them do, not all of them. Many of them are severely disabled psychiatrically or with a medical condition. But people are tenants. They have rules and regulations, just like if we were living in an apartment building. Mm-hmm. And so some of them, and they are all required to pay rent.
And so when you talk about paying rent, those who are unable to work, they still have some income from like Social Security or from somewhere? Or
they do. Some people have, a rare few have unemployment. Some have Social Security or Supplemental Security Disability income. Some people use their Alaska Native dividends to pay, or the PFD. But many do have limited sources of income, and that is applied to the rent cost.
I see. Does that reduce their disposable income so they can't buy as much alcohol, or is that a factor in this at all?
It is a factor. We work with every single tenant. Most of them we knew on the streets before they moved into Karluk Manor. And we work with getting people payees or guardians to assist them with this financial management aspect of living a healthier lifestyle. And when people are in safe housing and two or more meals are served a day, their reduction in alcohol use is extensive. It's over 30%. Reduced in their alcohol use, as well as improving their health. When you have improved health, you're able to make better choices.
Mm-hmm.
We have quite a few people at Karluk Manor that are clean and sober at any given time, and other people are working on sobriety or in treatment.
I see. And what about the argument that you are, in a sense, enabling behavior because it's so hard to be on the street and get alcohol and so forth, because to survive, and that sort of would tend to force you to straighten out, if it were. But if you have a nice apartment and you can keep doing negative behaviors, mm-hmm. that might make it easier, make the person be less likely to sort of hit bottom and deal with their problem.
Well, we can tell from decades of research, as well as all of us living here in our community, that what we have been doing has not been working. So people are drinking, whether they're on the streets and they're dying on the streets, or we invite them into safe housing with the responsibilities that go with being a tenant. And we are noticing, as well as extensive research, that they are reducing their self-destructive behaviors, if you will, and becoming more stabilized. And so the economic aspect, as well as the humanitarian, are the reasons that we opened Housing First at Carluck Manor.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller now. Jim is calling from Equoc. Jim, did you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I more or less had a comment. You know, I know that you know, most of the homeless people in and around Anchorage are from the communities, you know, throughout Alaska. You know, a solution possibly would be like opening up some of the sports fishing lodges. Like, we have a lodge here in Equoc that's empty. You know, if we could bring people from the, you know, reintroduce them back to Bush, Alaska, you know, give them a trade, you know, give them some, you know, training to process fish out in the Bering Sea or whatever it is, you know, first aid, some of these other things. But bring them back to the communities. I mean, that is the trick in this whole thing, you know, and it'll work. You know, if you have people who don't, they're not used to the city, how they ended up there with alcohol, you know, I've been down that road. You know, 15 years ago I sobered up, you know, I was, you know, my cousin brought me back to Kalignak, and, you know, and I've been living sober for 15 years. But, you know, I know I've been in that position, but to say, you know, I'm just making a comment that, you know, where they're from, we should try and bring them back and bring, you know, train them for jobs, because if you don't train them for anything, they're already trained to be bums and drunks on the street. So that's, you know, you got to alleviate and move on with something else. But thanks for your time. It's a real good subject. I've been advocating for this for a while, but have a good day, okay?
Thanks for the call, Jim. That was a real good point. Let me ask both my guests. Melinda, is that an option in order to getting people, you know, if they came from Bush, Alaska, somehow getting them back to Bush, Alaska? Is that something that you guys have looked at? Does that work?
Sure. We have looked at that in our Homeward Bound program, which is transitional housing. It's not permanent housing. And some people do choose to go back if they are welcomed back into their village. I do agree with the caller that you need to have the system of care or the services fit the individual. And so that's why we developed Housing First. We saw that people were dying in the streets. So we need to figure out a way, whether it's moving a person back to a village is one option for some folks. For some folks, they do want to choose to live in Anchorage because of the services here, the excellent health care that's provided, job opportunities. Remember, these are individuals that end up chronically homeless are not typically have the same background as other people. They have tremendous traumatic brain injuries, mental health issues, childhood trauma.
They're not homeless because they want to be.
No one wants to be homeless. This is a symptom of other problems. And if you can get people in safe and secure housing, you can begin to address these issues led to the homelessness in the first place.
Wanda, the caller also raised the point of the number of homeless in the streets who are from rural Alaska, Alaska Natives, and I don't know the percentages, but I understand it's a larger percentage than just sort of the usual population. And I was wondering if you have thought about how folks from village end up in the streets in Anchorage. What's the sort of, is there a typical pattern you see there of how that comes about?
Like Melinda said, there's a lot of history of traumatic events in their lives. You know, a lot of them have been in boarding schools. A lot of them have been abused during childhood. And when they do come to Anchorage, they get away from that. Not all, but most come from abuse.
Okay, yeah. Well, that makes sense, and that's a really good point for introducing my next guest. Nancy Burke is a program manager with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and is working in this homeless area because I guess a lot of the chronic homeless people are on the streets because of a mental health problem. Is that right, Nancy?
Yeah, thank you, Charles. We have been trying to understand some of those underlying issues that go along with homelessness. And we think that about a third of the people that are homeless are those that are what we might consider chronically homeless or have been homeless more than once. And we know that those folks are more than likely to be people that would be categorized as Mental Health Trust Authority beneficiaries, which includes people who have a mental illness or people with a chronic addiction. We also cover people who have developmental disabilities and seniors with Alzheimer's disease or related dementia conditions. And so we're interested in how the social services networks are supporting people who are on our streets. Anchorage did a really wonderful exercise last year in September. They did what they call a vulnerability assessment of people who were on the street. And they went out one morning, very early in the morning, so that they could capture people while they were still in camps or they were still in the places that they slept that night. And they interviewed 355 people. And of those people, they found that 161 met a criteria for being vulnerable, which means that they had either a substance abuse diagnosis, a mental illness, and some type of medical condition. So we found that people have extreme conditions. It's really that it's a very disabled population that's on the street.
So, I mean, in a past model and in past generation, people with mental illnesses would have been put in some kind of hospital or facility pretty much for life, sometimes inappropriately, sometimes appropriately. Today, we have a very small mental hospital API, and it's really only for people who are dangerous, right? And for Correct. Dangerous to other people or to themselves. So everybody else is out in the community, but they might not be able to function.
Yeah, and I think it's a great time for us to think about how policies impact us down, you know, literally to the street in this instance. We did move in the 70s and 80s to a community-based support system, and there were grants available and there were, you know, resources, the idea being that you would take money that was going into institutions of the time and then place that money into community resources. And over time, those community commitments at all levels, the federal level and the local level, have diminished, you know, and now we have a time where economics are driving further scarcity in those resources. And so we see the ability of programs to respond to people's needs limited. And we, you know, at the same time, we have no developmental disability institution in the state of Alaska. We're one of the few states in the nation that don't have that institution. However, the number of people we find on the street who might have that type of a diagnosis is really increasing. So, you know, it's a time for communities to really look at their commitment for support services and ensure that we're making decisions that will support people.
So when we're talking about developmental disability, we're talking about somebody who like cognitively maybe doesn't have the ability to really get a job or to get an apartment, and boy, that's tragic. I mean, that's I mean, we could put some blame on an alcoholic. Well, they could, you know, deal with their problem, but a person who simply has got a developmental problem, it's not their fault in any respect, and it seems very cold that we would leave them outside.
And if we, you know, if we look at some of the root causes of what we understand about mental illness, we know that people are born with predispositions to mental illness and to some extent addiction. I mean, we believe that addiction is a disease just like diabetes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we know that there are people who have who are predisposed to those conditions. And then environment and trauma and the number of people who reported having a brain injury on the street was very high in that survey. I'm going to go back and.
Well, you can come back to us.
I'll come back to that number, but you get the point. We're finding that people on the street, you know, we have a social view of those people, but when we really look at their conditions, we find that those folks are the ones who are really having some conditions that need extra support rather than fewer supports in shelter.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn to Heidi now, who's calling in with a question or comment. Heidi?
Yes, I have a comment. I find it a real crying shame that we're more willing to take dogs and cats off the street and keep them warm than we are with our own fellow human beings, firstly. Secondly, Davis and Walbridge, 1981, stated that the infant develops means for doing without constant care, and this is accomplished through the accumulation of memories of care and confidence in their environment. And I commend these people, Rural Cat, for doing this. It's been a long, long needed thing, because the traumatized people, they've been traumatized to the point where their trauma is unresolved, and they don't have emotional boundaries, and they don't know who to trust. Excuse me. And with this type of thing, they can learn trust again, help discover themselves, who they really are. And because sometimes their family doesn't give them a sense of who they really are in their family, because they're not welcome there, or number of reasons, maybe if they're handicapped or disabled in some form, fetal alcohol. It just depends on their situation. And most of these people go and they're incarcerated. And I feel that they should have assessments for every single person that goes into an incarceration situation. And I actually started a thing called Correction Connection. I have a business license, but I didn't know what to do with it, because I'm trying to help these people that come out. I've had friends that live here that they need everything involved in what these people are doing, not just one sense. I can't just give them a home. I have to give them every aspect to be successful and what they need to be successful themselves.
Okay, Heidi, that's a great comment. Let me turn to our guests.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for calling in. Melinda Freeman from RuralCap. I guess we count on the family to deal with a lot of problems that sometimes families aren't capable of dealing with. Is that sort of where this problem begins?
I think it's as Wanda said, it's a very complex problem. I think, Heidi, we want to invite you to a volunteer at Karluk Manor. I think you'd be wonderful. The problems are very complex. They are societal problems. They are involved with prejudices and stigmas that we have about people who live on the street without really understanding, as Nancy said, their history. Their histories are fraught with trauma. We have PTSD veterans. We have women who have been consistently sexually assaulted. Alcoholism, I want to clarify, is not a choice. It's a disease. It's a disease like diabetes, like other diseases where no one chooses to be diabetic, no one chooses to be an alcoholic. So the histories of the individuals, and I also want to point out that people are individuals. They're not categories. They're not statistics. They're individuals living on the streets with fabulously interesting histories. Some of them are very traumatic, but some of them are have college degrees. Many of us know professionals through car accidents end up with traumatic brain injuries, and they end up being homeless. So there, but for the grace of whoever, go I. Mm-hmm. And it's important to understand that there are histories that precede an individual ending up on the street. So I think Heidi has a very clear grasp of what happens when families are unable to raise children.
Wanda, let me ask you, since you're a case manager and you deal with people every day, is there typically a point where a family says, we can't handle this person anymore, or you know, you've run out of couches you can sleep on, and that's when you go from being kind of having a home to being homeless. Is that something you see a lot?
When they get to our program, they have usually severed all family ties, either because the family is where a lot of the problems began, or, you know, the family did all they could. So we're talking about chronically homeless, and, you know, that's a long time. So it's been a while before their family has stepped in, or they turn to their family.
So you're already way, way down the road and
yes,
into a situation where there really isn't any easy solution. Every solution is going to be hard at that point.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this is a really fascinating topic, and we've got a lot more to talk about, but it's time for a break. You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. Please stay with us.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Providence Imaging Center, with Doctors Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVImaging.com. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth sitting in for Steve Heimel this week. Our topic is homelessness, particularly chronic homelessness and the terrible problems of folks freezing outdoors because they don't have a place to stay, and maybe they have an addiction problem or a mental health problem that makes it really hard for them to find a place to stay. There's a new movement called Housing First, which is essentially getting folks apartments, even if they don't stop drinking, even if their problems aren't solved, and then trying to address some of those problems. There's a facility now up and running in Anchorage, Karluk Manor, another facility in Fairbanks, coming in the future in Juneau and in other communities. So this is something that's spreading across Alaska, and it's something we need to talk about. We've got three guests in the studio. Melinda Freeman is director of Supportive Housing Division at RuralCAP. Wanda Connolly is a case manager at RuralCAP, and Nancy Burke is with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We'd love to have you on the air as well. The phone number statewide, toll-free, is 800-478-8255. That's 800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, you can dial 550-8422. And email is talk@alaskapublic.org. I'd like to ask an email question now that has come in, and if I can deal with the computer here. Yes, this is from Diane. I think this is a great program, but wonder what sort of community considerations are taken into account with these facilities. There are a couple of neighborhoods that are overwhelmed with these high-need individuals. Is there any indication that Karluk Manor has been a positive addition to the Fairview community as a whole? And I turn to you, Melinda Freeman, because I know that this downtown part of Anchorage has a lot of homeless people. It has facilities such as Brother Francis Shelter and Beans Cafe and others, and people in that area felt put upon that there are more and more homeless facilities in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Diane, for that question. Before we opened Karluk Manor, we reviewed for about 2 to 3 years the various sites that were possibilities for opening a Housing First. And this particular property was fit the severe alcohol-dependent housing ordinance. There's an ordinance currently in Anchorage that dictates where we can place facilities like Housing First. And that particular location of the Red Roof Inn fit that location. We are always very interested. We attend all of the community councils. We also conducted a neighborhood survey recently at the end of May to inquire with all of the businesses and residents, how do you feel that the operation of Karluk Manor is affecting you? And we didn't get very many responses. About 70% of the responses were very positive. And there were other folks that were saying that they hadn't really noticed the facility or what we're doing there. So there is a concern, but what I'd like to point out is that people were living on the streets in the Fairview area before we safely placed them in housing. So some of the concerns were, would people who were homeless and alcoholic congregate at Karluk Manor? Would people be unsafe there that worked there or the surrounding businesses? And we found from asking that our neighbors, our businesses and residents, what they feel about the property, people seem to be quite positive about it. Okay. We also have an evaluation that will tell the community exactly what is the economic impact of Karluk Manor as we move forward with it.
Wanda, in terms of where homeless are, and we're talking about the chronic homeless, who a large number of them have substance abuse problems, where they're located in Anchorage, does that seem like it's determined by where the liquor stores are? Is it determined by where there's a place to camp? I mean, what do you have a feel for why people congregate in certain areas in town?
Not really. We do have downtown, we do have BFS or Brother Francis and Beans and Soup Kitchens. But we have people out in Diamond, we have people out in Muldoon, we have people near Campbell Creek. So the homeless are all over Anchorage.
So they're spread widely, and so it's not, we may see them downtown, but that may not
yes,
be the only place
more
where they're located.
Visible downtown.
Mm-hmm. Now I'd like to go to Jim, who's got a question or comment about disability issues. Jim?
Yeah, thank you, Charles, and I really appreciate the show and your guests. There's been some fantastic comments, and I work for an organization called Access Alaska, and we help people with disabilities live independently in the community and also consider ourselves a disability rights organization. And I think it was Melinda who talked about this being a group that anyone can join at any time. We're the largest minority in America, folks with disabilities. And without a doubt, many of the people who are on the streets were walking down the street sometime in their life, just like anybody else, and found themselves in this unique circumstance of joining this large disability group. And I'm really intrigued with perhaps where Housing First is going, what the future looks like. It's easy to criticize any new progressive way of helping. This is just such a complicated issue. It's not like trying to convince businesses to build a ramp or why accessible parking is important. This is services for people who largely society kind of tends to not want to deal with. So I just appreciate the work that's happening around this issue, and wonder how this will look in 10 years. And I'm quite sure at that point it will probably be the biggest disability rights issue in our country by then. I'm wondering if your guests have any comments on that.
Yeah, let's turn to Melinda for that.
Yeah, thank you.
The future of Housing First.
Thank you for your comments. I see the future as a very powerful one for all individuals and families. We need to address homelessness and ideally prevent it. But in the case where we are unable to prevent it, like you addressed, the future, I think, involves continued programs for chronically homeless people, more affordable housing in Anchorage, so individuals who have situational housing issues or homelessness, or they are on very lean incomes and our rent costs are very high. We have less than 2% vacancy rate in Anchorage for apartments. So as we continue to build as a community more affordable housing, that will prevent future homelessness. But for this population, the earlier we can get people treatment, mental health treatment, addictions treatment, proper care and concern during their childhood, all of these will reduce homelessness and reduce the impact of chronic homelessness on our community. So I think it is a bright future, but it takes a lot of partnerships, it takes funding, and it takes vision and a commitment.
And I want to take that question over to Nancy Burke from the Mental Health Trust Authority, because, I mean, there's this question of we don't want to warehouse people, right? We want to get them the treatment they need. Is there, are there enough resources for people to get mental health support at the community level?
There just really are not. excuse me.
Do you need a glass of water?
You choked me up. Jim's question choked me up. Yeah. It really is an access to housing issue. You know, if you think about the Americans with Disabilities Act, stated that people with disabling conditions needed to have access to things that are available in the community. And that's really one of the driving principles behind Housing First, is that we really had a number of our housing resources linked to specific types of services. And so if you didn't fit that exact type of service, then you couldn't continue to participate in your housing. So nationally, the effort has been to separate out housing as something that really people say everyone has a right to have access to housing, and then services need to layer in on top of it. And I think, you know, particularly in Alaska, we're rated as the 12th most expensive community for rental units and for ownership in the nation by one of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And it just speaks to the number of affordable units that we have available is not adequate. And then additionally, our support services really do need some attention. It gets to some funding mechanisms about how we're paying for those services, but the gist of it is that we need to continue working on that.
Okay, thanks, Jim. That was a good good comment. I want to move on to the next caller. Don is on the line. Don, did you have a comment or question?
Yes, I do. Part of it goes in conjunction with what your party just mentioned. That was the availability and the cost of housing, which kind of turned my stomach when I saw the bulldozers going in and smashing vacant houses, because they, rather than fix them up and rent them, they just, whoever was handling the financing decided they wanted to tear it down instead. And there's been a lot of it, especially in North Mountain View and a few other parts of the city. My main reason for calling was about 10 years ago, I was on probation. I was over in Brother Francis Shelver, to whom I'm very grateful for a good solid leg up in order to give me a hand getting back into a place of my own, getting myself organized again. I received a lot of help from them as far as being able to get a room of my own away from the shelter later. And a lot of people don't seem to understand just how far they go, because they don't just give you a 30-day restriction. You can go on there for like 7 months, as long as you've got a job and keep your nose clean, whatever. But as was also alluded to earlier, a lot of people have compounded situations where they're taking drugs or something for pain or one type of medication or another. They end up mixing it with alcohol or whatever, and they get going off the deep end. I have had occasion where I've helped a person or two. I've seen them get back on a job for as much as 8 months at a pop, and they do fine until something comes up for whatever reason. They end up backsliding, or they get in some cases fights and arguments with old friends or family, and they end up getting dragged back down again. I think it was also pointed out that a lot of times the family is one or two members of it, at least, are the part of the basic cause for the anxiety and the angst that is part of their illness. It's very, very difficult for somebody to try and be a responsible person and go the way which even they want to go when you have somebody else pulling them down with, no, you can't do this, or I won't let you, or I can't, or attitude. And it's just so heavy with negativity that it just drags people down, and it is something where the person doing that needs help.
Yeah, I mean, these
are going to be the one who refuses to go for help.
It's an onion. There's definitely layers within layers. That's a great comment,
yes.
Don. Thanks for calling in. We're going to keep going because we've got a lot of other callers, but I really do appreciate your call. And it kind of leads into this email that I received from Joe. I think it is difficult for many of us to drive by homeless folks looking for money on the local street corners. We don't want to give them money due to the risk of it going to alcohol, so it makes it hard to look them in the eye when you can't do anything. And then he suggests a website that he'd like to set up to provide homeless people with information about what they can access in terms of resources in the community. I guess from my own perspective, I've given money to homeless people only to see them ask me for money with the same phony story the very next day. You know, they don't recognize me. Or I remember a friend who brought some groceries to a guy who had, you know, will work for food, and he threw the food down on the ground. And so you sort of lose some sympathy, and you then start thinking, well, how are we supposed to respond? You know, we want to be sympathetic and empathetic. But we know that giving money might be the worst thing you could do. I don't know who wants to take that one. Nancy, do you have a comment on it?
I have people in my life and friends who are on all points of that continuum. They say, you know, giving someone money is definitely a way of supporting them. And, you know, maybe that'll be the time that they decide to make a decision that'll move them forward. I mean, just as every day I go out to spend my money, I have to think about, you know, how am I going to use it today? It's happens for me as well. And then I have other friends who say, you know, giving people money isn't the way they choose to go. Some people carry vouchers for McDonald's, or they someone dear to me takes somebody to lunch almost every day. When he sees them on the corner, he picks them up and drives them over to McDonald's and sit and talk with that person. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I think human contact is probably in whatever form you choose to take, that's probably the piece that I think would
probably
restore
talk about
dignity.
Your husband, Reverend Michael Burke. Right?
I am talking about him.
Yeah, I figured. Teresa has a comment now from Wasilla. Teresa?
My Rotary Club in Wasilla has just gotten involved with a group called My House, and it's a newly formed organization, and they're targeting the youth in the valley. Right now, I believe there's a youth population, homeless population, of 500 to 700 kids out here. And My House is targeting the kids that are 14 to 24, so it kind of overlaps the foster system. They're still working with Child Protection Protective Services to see how they can better serve the 14 to 18-year-olds. But the 18 to 20-year-olds are very active with. And right now, the big problem in the Valley is there's no place to house the kids at all. So they're having to actually pay for transportation to send some of them into Anchorage so that they have the place to sleep at night.
Okay. Thanks. That's a good comment. I don't know if we need to add anything to that, but that's good information to put out there. I want to thank you for calling, Teresa. We're going to have to take a break now. It's Talk of Alaska. We'll be back in just a moment.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Kinnick Arm Bridge would create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
It's Talk of Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'm sitting in for Steve Heimel. We are talking about the issue of homelessness in Alaska and this new idea of housing first, which is spreading all over the state, getting people a safe place to sleep. We had a question about what to do with panhandlers, and there is a website called changeforthebetteralaska.org. Which has some suggestions on how to deal with homeless panhandlers. It looks like it hasn't been updated in about a year, but that might be a good place to start if that's a concern that affects you. I think it affects most of us who drive around Anchorage every day. I've got three guests in the studio. Melinda Freeman is director of Rural CAP Supportive Housing Division. Wanda Connolly is a Rural CAP case manager, and Nancy Burke is with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and lots of callers calling in at 800-478-8255. We have just a few minutes left, but I want to go to Joshua now, who's calling from Soldotna. Joshua?
Hello, good morning.
Yeah, did you have a comment or a question?
I do. I have two things I wanted to ask everyone about this morning. First thing, I'd like to know how this program will affect or help families. So basically, the reason I asked that question is I was involved in a situation where I was homeless with my family. We lived in California at the time. And every program we could find that would help us split us up. The place where the kids would have a safe place to sleep didn't include me. There was no abuse in the family, but there were money problems. And then that brings me to my second comment or question, and that is, I guess how can we help people who have made these mistakes, like drug and alcohol offenders? I was one of those who had offenses on my record that prevented me from getting a job or a driver's license or pretty much anything. I was limited. I was cut out of society for a period of time, and it affected my ability to provide for my family and regardless of my willingness to be clean and sober, my record held me back. It was very frustrating. And so we need to find a niche for these folks I found my own way, but it took a lot of strength and a lot of determination on my part. I really felt like I went way, way far the other direction, which some people aren't strong enough to do. And those folks, if they just had a safe place to sleep with their family for even a month, they might be able to be strong enough, make the right decisions, and they need someone to let them in. They need someone to say, it's okay, even though you're a felon, or even though you have no driver's license, we'll give you a job, things like that. And I'll take my responses out there. I appreciate you guys.
I thank you for calling, Joshua. It's been really great that we've been hearing from formerly homeless people. It shows it's not a hopeless problem, right? It's a problem that does get solved. There are two good questions there. One about folks with criminal records and the other about families. And Nancy, did you want to chime in on that?
I wanted to respond to the piece about families, and that is probably one of the next steps for this model. There are programs, particularly one main program in California that has worked with families to address just that situation that Joshua described, that if you come into shelter or if you need resources, oftentimes programs are built around a mom and children, or programs are just for adults. And so you find a family has to face the choice of, well, do we break up while we all go try to go to treatment, or is there a way that we can stay together? And there's actually been some work by the courts in Anchorage and many of the partners trying to see if we can't address that situation, particularly working through OCS for families that are identified as likely to break up as a result of, you know, the conditions. So if we can get the housing in place, again, it's the same principle. If people can be housed and then services can be brought in, everyone can get what they need and the family can stay together and be strengthened.
Now, there is a family shelter in Anchorage, is there not? Clare House? And that's a Catholic, is that the right name of it?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a Catholic Catholic social services program. But I assume you have to be clean and sober to be there, or what's the situation with that?
You don't have to be clean and sober, but you that's for women and children. McKinnell House, run by the Salvation Army, is the only family shelter in our community where you can be a two-parent family or a single father with children. And some of the efforts in our community are the homeless prevention rapid rehousing efforts through Catholic Social Services to, when someone is in danger of being evicted, to help them bridge that gap. But I also want to respond to Joshua, and I want to say congratulations for your tremendous strength in helping move out of your background, which was challenging, and that our court system, our criminal justice system, is working on prisoner reentry. That is a focus area with Alaska Housing right now in trying to find proper housing for people with criminal backgrounds who may be rejected or not allowed to move into apartments.
Okay. I have an email here, and I think I might take it a little different direction than the listener is taking it. She says, my son, who's alcoholic, lives in public housing. He's been threatened with eviction by the housing authority for talking too loud in the early morning. Upstairs neighbors complained because he had friends over and was talking too loud. They called the cops, resulting in threat of eviction. Kathleen wants to know if it's illegal to kick somebody out when they have alcoholism. It's a disease. I guess I side a little bit with the neighbors. That kind of noise, you're trying to sleep, you're trying to get ready for work, that's a problem. But it leads into another question about housing first. What kind of behavior is required for the folks living in the building? I mean, is it Animal House? I mean, how do you keep things under control if you've got a group of people who are a lot of people with substance abuse problems that presumably are still drinking?
Yeah, well, good question. It is illegal to evict someone due to their alcoholism. It is not illegal to evict someone who has behavior that is impacting the calm and peaceful enjoyment of the other tenants in the building. At Carluck Manor, we have very simple rules. We don't have pages of rules. We only have 5 rules. Pay your rent on time, no illegal activity, do not damage the building, no violence in the building, and be a good neighbor. So it is an Animal House. It's active. I'll say that. It's active. It's busy. We have activities there. We have AA meetings. We have 24-hour staffing. We have meals. We have wonderful volunteers that come in. So in programs such as this, you really need to respond to the individual and make sure that the collective whole is run properly and that people are respectful of each other in the facility.
You do presumably have to kick people out sometimes.
We have evicted some people whose behavior was too problematic to remain in housing, but we also have strict visiting hours and visiting rules. No more than 10 people can visit at a time in the whole facility. It's a single point of entry. We monitor who's in the building at all times, and it seems to be working very well.
Okay. I'd like to turn to Harold now, calling from Chivac. Harold?
Yeah, hello. I know there's lots of that going on in Anchorage, and it's just that the people need to do a lot more of their there's lots of that people. Go reset it. There's lots of the people that needs to do the rehab, and you know, they're get back on drinking again, and just that they won't. It's hard for them, you know, just to, because their mind is set on being homeless and don't want to do that, get to work, and it's like you're going to be there, and, well, I don't know. It's just that they got to get their mindset of not drinking.
Yeah, rehab doesn't always work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that they're going to slide back. It's just that people got to talk to them. You know, there's someone that has to be there in order to make them not think about that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and so let me turn...
There's people that I'll think about for that next drink or how they're going to get it, you know?
And there's been some, turning back to Melinda, there have been some people who've died in Carlick Manor who maybe just never, rehab never did work. Is that right?
Yes, we have had several people pass away at Carlick Manor, and we were grateful that they were safe and in a warm, caring environment. But you're absolutely right. In Seattle, when we studied their program, people had an average of 19 times that they had participated in substance abuse treatment before they were able to be safely housed. So people do participate in treatment. There are people in treatment right now at Carlick Manor. Treatment does work, mental health and substance abuse treatment, but there are many side effects to mental health medications that most of us wouldn't like as well. And it's important to note that most Americans, according to the Corporation for Supportive Housing, are three paychecks away from homelessness. Yeah.
And that's a good place to finish the show because we are out of time. I want to thank my guests, Melinda Freeman from Rural CAP and also Wanda Connolly from Rural CAP and Nancy Burke from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Lots more that we could talk about and that we'd like to talk about. You can follow up on our website and on Facebook at alaskapublic.org. We have links and more information. And I also want to thank Dave Waldron, who is engineering today's show, and Josh Edge on the phones. My name is Charles Wolforth. Lori Townsend will be with you next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.